I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, HRW reports the Syrian government is conducting unlawful attacks on civilians. The group of eight agree on increasing humanitarian access in Syria. Iran nuclear talks are suspended but not at an impasse.
From the point of view of our work, of this process, of the atmosphere of the talks, we have progressed far ahead.
And U.S. drone strikes are under further scrutiny. It's all ahead. Human Rights Watch says Syria is carrying out unlawful attacks against civilians and is urging the international community to pressure the government to stop. The group released a new report describing 59 airstrikes in opposition areas of Aleppo, Idlib, and Latakia between August and December last year. We got details of their findings from Nadim Hurri, spokesman for Human Rights Watch.
This report is an extensive investigation into airstrikes in northern Syria. It's based on visits to 50 sites of government airstrikes in the last 3 months of last year, and documents the killing of more than 152 civilians in these strikes. What the report found was that the Syrian Air Force has repeatedly carried out indiscriminate, and in some cases even deliberate, attacks against civilians. These attacks constitute war crimes, and when they are carried out as part of a government policy, they even amount to crimes against humanity.
Well, it's hard to believe, but is the situation in Syria actually becoming worse than it was already?
Unfortunately, it has. It's the killing, the airstrikes, not only are they impacting people that are being hit, but they're also affecting life in large parts of the country because people live in constant fear of what's going to happen. So many parents, for example, don't send their children to schools. Many parents have stopped lining up to buy bread at bakeries because of repeated airstrikes on bakeries. So it's just really creating a sense of constant fear and terror amongst the civilian population, particularly given some of the weapons that are being used by the Syrian Air Force, including cluster munitions, which are inherently indiscriminate.
And what about the opposition? Are they also in violation of rights?
Yes. I mean, we've been documenting a number of violations by the opposition. With respect to airstrikes, obviously the armed opposition does not have any air force. Their violations are mostly tied to the fact that they have not taken all necessary precautions to protect civilians and minimize harm. For example, by sometimes basing themselves in houses or buildings in civilian areas. But even in these cases, that does not relieve the obligation of the attacker of the Syrian Air Force to take the necessary precautions to minimize harm to civilians, which is something that they clearly have not done.
Could you be a little bit more specific about what you would like them to do to protect civilians?
Sure. I mean, they could base themselves outside of civilian areas. They could take precautions to tell civilians to be far away from where they may put their weapons. But again, that's not the leading cause of death. The leading cause of death is really the indiscriminate and sometimes deliberate attacks on civilians by the Syrian Air Force. I mean, just to give you an example, many of the helicopters are using barrel bombs. These are sort of makeshift bombs prepared by the Syrian Air Force, sometimes on their bases. And they just drop these bombs from the back of the helicopter from very high places without any real targeting. So they're really punishing the civilian population in the areas where the opposition has taken control.
Nadim Hurri, Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa with Human Rights Watch, speaking with us from their bureau in Beirut, Lebanon. HRW is also urging governments and companies to stop selling and sending weapons and ammunition to Syria. The crisis in Syria has been a major topic of discussion at the G8 Foreign Ministers Conference in London. British Foreign Secretary William Hague, at a news conference today, expressed the seriousness of the situation.
This is on track to be the biggest humanitarian catastrophe of the 21st century so far, what is happening in Syria, with now about 1.25 million refugees in neighboring countries, with more than 5 million people in urgent need of assistance, with the risk of the causing greater instability in neighboring countries, particularly in Lebanon. This is a very, very dangerous crisis. So it is a major failure of the Security Council that it's not been able to address that in a united way. I'm not blaming that on all the members of the Security Council when we've had some resolutions vetoed on this. It's been a vote of 13-2, of course, but Russia and China have vetoed our attempts to come to a united position on it. And in current circumstances, if we put forward the same resolutions, I think that the same thing would happen. So it is a major failing, and that is why we increasingly have to address it in other ways, but ways that are designed to promote the political settlement that the UN should be, the UN Security Council should be trying to bring about. This is why we have been increasing our support for the opposition. We have to do that to save lives, but also to make clear to the regime in Syria that in the end they will have to agree to a political settlement. We will continue to pursue that track, including, if necessary, in new ways. If there continues to be no agreement at the Security Council.
Britain and France have advocated amending or lifting a European Union arms embargo on Syria to support the rebels. Russia and Germany oppose such a move, arguing it could allow weapons to fall into the hands of Islamist militants and fuel a regional conflict. Mr. Haig says this is a concern.
We are still deadlocked on the diplomatic front. Therefore, we have to continue to increase the support we give in terms of humanitarian support and our political and practical support to the opposition. Of course, it's very important that any such support is not diverted into extremist or terrorist groups. Part of the case for giving support to moderate people in the Syrian opposition is because we are concerned that Syria is now the number one destination for jihadists in the world. We are concerned about the growth of extremist groups. That always has to be seen in context. We don't believe the Syrian people in general are given to extremism. That is not their nature. But advantage can be taken of this situation by foreign fighters attracted to the area and to the conflict. That's part of the case for trying to help bring it to a conclusion as soon as possible. It's part of the case for increasing the help that we give in various ways to, as I say, to the moderate opposition. But we've stressed in our meetings with them, my French and American colleagues and I have stressed in the meetings we had with them yesterday, how very important it is that any help we give them today or in the future cannot be diverted to extremist groups or end up in the wrong hands. And we will all remain absolutely adamant about that.
The British Foreign Secretary outlined action on Syria by the G8 foreign ministers.
We agreed that our immediate priorities are increasing humanitarian access, ensuring that donors who generously pledged their support at the Kuwait conference fulfill their commitments, and supporting stability in the countries that are providing shelter to refugees. And we also welcomed the UN Secretary General's announcement of an investigation into the possible use of chemical weapons in Syria. This week, the United Kingdom, United States, and France also held separate talks before the G8 meeting with the Syrian National Coalition, the Syrian opposition, where we emphasized our support and discussed how to intensify our work with them, particularly on better delivery of services and humanitarian assistance inside Syria, other practical support, and on achieving a political solution in Syria. The Assad regime has shown a flagrant disregard for human rights and human life, and continues to do so. Now is the time, of course, for a Syrian-led political transition that respects the democratic aspirations of the Syrian people.
British Foreign Secretary William Haig speaking in London today. The G8 includes the United States, Britain, Germany, France, Italy, Japan, Canada, and Russia. The head of Syria's main Islamist rebel group, al-Nusra, has sworn allegiance to al-Qaeda, deepening a rift with moderate rebels over how to rule the nation if they topple President Bashar al-Assad. Abu Mohammed al-Golani made the pledge of loyalty to al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in an audio message posted on militant websites Wednesday. Al-Qaeda in Iraq chief Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi announced the alliance in a separate audio message posted on the Internet a day before. For some perspective on the relationship between al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the fractious Syrian opposition, VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with Benedetta Berti, a research fellow at the Institute for International Security Studies at Tel Aviv University.
There was never one cohesive front to fighting Assad since the beginning of the protests. But as the conflict evolved and became bloodier and more complex and more protracted, you have really seen the fragmentation of the Syrian oppositions. And together with the fragmentation, you also have seen the rise of more radical elements from this within the Syrian opposition groups. And the past 6 months have really seen this very strong rise of al-Nusra. And whereas they at the beginning they were definitely a marginal phenomenon, now they cannot be ignored anymore, both in terms of the actual percentage of the fighting that they carry out, but also in terms of the percentage of the fighters they're able to, the new fighters they're able to attract.
We asked whether al-Nusra's relationship with al-Qaeda has affected its successes in Syria.
They're really reliable information in terms of the logistics and the operations going on in Syria is extremely difficult. So we're more or less all speculating when we look at this. But I would say that the logistic operation and the training has been going on for a while, and it's something that is a force multiplier for al-Nusra. But even more important has been the fact that from the beginning of this factionalization process of the Syrian opposition, you've been seeing that most of the weapons coming from outside, for coming from abroad and going into the Syrian opposition, have been going to the Islamist groups, not just to al-Nusra, but to the larger Islamist groups. And from what I understand, based on my sources, I think it's fair to assume that most of the weapons coming from the Qataris and been going to the Muslim Brotherhood, and most of the weapons coming from the Saudis have been going to the Salafists. Some of them trickling down to al-Nusra as well. So it's not just a logistic cooperation with al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's also a matter that this group has been getting better weapons if compared to the more moderate, shall we say, or secular parts of the Syrian opposition.
Benedetta Berti, a research fellow at the Institute for International Security Studies at Tel Aviv University. The latest round of nuclear talks between Iran and the six countries representing the United Nations ended over the weekend with no substantive progress or plan for more meetings. But both sides promised to be in touch after taking some time to evaluate each other's ideas. Al Pessin reports from London for VOA Television. The process is suspended but has not reached a dangerous impasse.
The delegates gathered in Kazakhstan amid hope they would build on the upbeat atmosphere of the last round of talks there in February. Some believed there was a chance of agreement on first steps toward ending the dispute over Iran's nuclear program. But as EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton noted, it didn't turn out that way.
It became clear the positions of the E3+3 and Iran remain far apart on the substance.
Other participants agreed, but did their best to put a positive spin on the situation.
From the point of view of our work, of this process, of the atmosphere of the talks, we have progressed far ahead.
Representatives tabled the points of view of their respective countries and announced that they will need to make further assessments.
The five permanent Security Council members and Germany want an end to Iranian enrichment to near weapons grade and full UN inspections to prove it. The Iranians want recognition of their right to enrich uranium, even to weapons grade, and an end to international sanctions. To some extent, both sides are playing for time until after the Iranian election in June. But U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says there's a limit.
This is not an interminable process. So we hope that out of Almaty will come a narrowing of some of the differences, Diplomacy is a painful task and a task for the patient.
There's concern that if there's no significant progress in the talks, and soon, the United States or Israel could take military action against Iran's nuclear facilities. And even with two rounds of talks already this year, there's no guarantee of significant progress, according to the nuclear expert at London's International Institute for Strategic Studies, Mark Fitzpatrick.
I don't think 2013 will produce a solution to the Iran nuclear program. If it can produce at least a partial agreement, that would be a very favorable and welcome development. Now, 2013 could also be a very negative year if Iran does not accept any limits to its program, if it keeps expanding.
The next indication of which way 2013 will go should come within a few weeks, when officials consult at long distance about whether and when to meet again. Until then, Iranian enrichment goes on, the crippling economic sanctions continue, and the two sides remain far apart. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
The United States' use of unmanned drones to strike terrorists is coming under increasing scrutiny. Those in favor say the drone strikes are highly effective, but critics suggest they could violate international law. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Unmanned drones are being used with increasing frequency in fighting terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. A recent analysis by the New America Foundation estimated drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen since 2004 have killed up to 3,238 militants and as many as 368 civilians. Professor Christopher Coker of the London School of Economics is author of Warrior Geeks, How 21st Century Technology is Changing the Way We Fight and Think About War.
There are six American bases, four in the United States, one in Germany and one in South Korea, and that's where most of the drone strikes are launched from. And they have chaplains and psychologists now in the room monitoring. They have machines monitoring stress levels, also monitoring concentration levels. And there is, of course, a chain of command. So you spend about 8 hours looking at the screen day after day, and occasionally you get the command to actually fire.
The New York Times newspaper alleged Sunday that Pakistan is allowing U.S. drones in its airspace in return for targeted killings of Pakistan's enemies by the drones. The Pakistani government strongly denied the allegations. The U.S. government did not comment. The drone strikes have prompted street protests in Pakistan. Arif Niazi is a lawyer in Islamabad.
ये ड्रोन हमले जो जारी हैं ये सरासर हमारी
He says that these ongoing attacks are blatant aggression, an intrusion into his country and a violation of its sovereignty. Marco Rossini, an expert on international law at the University of Westminster, says the legality of current drone strikes is murky.
There's a huge need for clarification and there's a huge need for transparency. We don't know, you know, that most of the strikes are now allegedly carried out by the CIA and their covert operations. So we don't know why, who, and when an individual is put in the targeted list.
The decision on whom to target is a key distinction between CIA drone strikes and the military, says Professor Christopher Coker of the London School of Economics.
The military can only actually take out someone if they know 100% that it's a bad guy. The CIA will take you out on the basis that your behaviour leads you to suspect or leads them to suspect that you may be a bad guy.
Supporters of drone strikes point to the killing of numerous high-profile targets, such as last year's strike in Pakistan that killed the then number two in Al-Qaeda, Abu Yahya al-Libi. At his nomination hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee in February, CIA Director John Brennan was questioned about the use of drones to kill U.S. citizens suspected of joining terror groups.
I think any American who did that should know well that they, in fact, are part of an enemy against us and that the United States will do everything possible to destroy that enemy to save American lives.
With most NATO ground forces withdrawing from Afghanistan at the end of 2014, analysts say drones could play a bigger role in the West's fight against Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.